Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
24 suspected members of Al-Qaeda are on trial today in Madrid, three of them believed to have had roles in planning the September 11th terrorist attacks in the U.S. Also today, Zakarias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, is expected to plead guilty in a Virginia courtroom to charges related to the 9/11 hijackings. Moussaoui was arrested 1 month before the September attacks. Joining us on the line is Faye Bowers, national security correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Faye, I understand this is the second time a judge has agreed to hear Moussaoui's plea, but last time around he changed his mind. He didn't plead guilty. So is that a serious expectation that he will today?
I think it's probably about 50-50, Robin. Government officials say, you know, they expect him to plead guilty, but they say, you know, anything can happen with this guy. It's happened before, as you mentioned.
Right. And what happens if he does plead guilty? Will it go directly to a sentencing phase?
That will be separate. They will hold a sentencing hearing later and separately.
And so no trial. Some say U.S. officials were hoping for a trial that would, you know, show the horrors of Al-Qaeda.
I think some were, but I think some are very happy not to have a trial because of the evidence, or lack of evidence, I guess I should say, against him.
Well, and will he face the death penalty? Because there was also a fear that that is something that he embraced because it would make him a martyr.
That's right, and I believe he will face the death penalty. That's at least what government officials are saying so far.
We talked about the evidence against him. What, if anything, has Moussaoui said in the past about his knowledge of the September 11th attacks?
He said very little about his knowledge of the September 11th attacks. He's made clear that he was for them, and he's made clear that he's a member of Al-Qaeda and that he's pledged loyalty to Osama bin Laden. But he has stated in court and in his pleadings that he wasn't part of the 9/11 plane hijacking plan.
Yeah, and yet this is a bitter reminder, if he pleads guilty, that Zakarias Moussaoui was in custody before 9/11, and there were memos sent to then CIA Director George Tenet with concerns that Moussaoui was taking flying lessons, could perhaps crash a plane into a building. It's a reminder that there was that fear.
That's right. There, you know, as you mentioned, there were several, you know, an FBI agent as well as some CIA people picked up some information that there were people in the United States with plans of this sort, but no one ever connected the dots, as all of the commissions have pointed out. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, you know, government officials have changed their stance on Moussaoui as well. They've accused him of being the 20th hijacker, but they've backed off that claim. They now say the 20th hijacker is another guy named Al-Qahtani that they apprehended in Florida maybe a year or so ago and transferred to Guantanamo.
And by the way, there's been questions about Musawi's competency. If he pleads guilty, are there those who still feel he may not be?
I'm sure there are some of those who feel he may not be, including his lawyers. But, you know, Judge Brinkema met with him on Wednesday and said she declared him competent.
Yeah. A quick question. We mentioned that in Spain, a trial of 24 men begins today. It's expected to last 2 to 4 months, the result of an 8-year investigation, yet 9/11 happened 4 years ago. Were there missed opportunities there?
Possibly, but, you know, it's sort of like the cell probably that was in the United States with, you know, who is euphemistically referred to as the blind shaker, Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, who had been found guilty for being behind the 93 World Trade Center, car bombing. These men kind of went out around the world after they left Afghanistan in the late 80s, early 90s, the Mujahideen who were there fighting with Osama bin Laden. Many of them went back to their home countries and joined or rejoined jihadist cells. Some of them went to other countries where they sought asylum because they were not permitted to go home and created sleeper cells, which provide kind of logistic support, you know, money, a place to stay, that sort of thing, which is really hard for countries or legal entities to prove that that's a crime of aiding and abetting a terrorist cell or a terrorist action if they don't know what the person actually did.
Well,
if the person didn't have direct knowledge of the crime.
Well, Faye, meanwhile, just a few seconds left. We just want to note that you write today that Middle East experts are surprised that with all the billions of dollars spent on the 9/11 investigation in the U.S., only Moussaoui stands accused in this country. Again, just a few seconds, but that seems to be the attitude.
That's right. Well, you know, there are these three high-level al-Qaeda officials being detained by the United States that have provided intelligence, and they're the ones who are responsible for the plot itself and for making sure it was carried out. And they are being detained, apparently, for their intelligence value.
But not put on trial. Faye Bowers, national security correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Faye, thank you.
You're welcome.
Lebanon got a new prime minister and a new cabinet this week, and today the prime minister vowed to hold elections by the end of next month. Meanwhile, Syria says that by next Tuesday, all of its troops and all of its intelligence officers will have left Lebanon. Also, two top pro-Syrian security officers in Lebanon have stepped aside after complaints that they were obstructing an investigation into the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri last February. Is it a new dawn for Lebanon? We're joined first by Mosbah Abdab. He's a member of the Lebanese parliament, one of those committed to getting Syria to withdraw its troops. Welcome, Mosbah.
Thank you. Welcome.
And can you help us with this latest turn of events, a new prime minister? It's confusing on this end because we understand that the new prime minister, Najib Mikati, is a very close friend of Syria. And we understood that his predecessor, the interim prime minister, had to quit because he was so pro-Syrian, he couldn't get anyone in Lebanon to follow him. So how is it that Najib Mikati is being embraced?
Well, definitely Najib Mikati is one of the closest people to, closest politicians in Lebanon to Syria. But he came as an agreement done between the different groups in Lebanon, since one has to remember that Syria still has a majority of parliamentarians in parliament. So instead of going through the dynamics of stalling elections like it was, or postponing the formation of a government like it was with Mr. Karami, who was before Najib Mikati, the compromise now is to have Mr. Mikati form a transition government that would vow to hold elections before the end of May, and also commit to deal with an international commission of investigation concerning the assassination of President Hariri, and also he vowed to dismiss all the chiefs of security institutions in Lebanon, and it was one of the major requests of the opposition. So it's a transition period we're going through, and I think that it is definitely a positive period, because this would avoid confrontation and this would give us the possibility of making soft landing in Lebanon.
Soft landing, that's the phrase you use, as opposed to a very combustible hard break.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we had some threats during last month. We've had a couple of car bombs. We've had some politicians threatening in a way or another, saying that there will be a security vacuum, and would be much better if we can avoid this kind of action.
You say that in addition to the car bombs, there were threats. Were you threatened, and who's doing the threatening?
Well, you know, we have a whole structure of security institutions, and they have been interfering in politics, and there were some threats. I personally was threatened, and it went public during the renewal of the mandate of President Lahoud, because I wanted to vote against it, and I still did, actually. But there were 52 members of parliament who openly declared wanting to vote against the amendment of constitution to renew the mandate of President Lahoud. And at the end, we were only 29 in parliament because of all the threats that people went through.
When you say security operations, do you mean police? Are these Lebanese police? Are these Syrian-backed organizations?
Well, it was definitely mixed Syrian-Lebanese secret services. This is how the country was ran for the last 10 years.
Do we understand that you actually went on television to say that you had been threatened in an effort to protect yourself?
Yes, I did. That was in September.
Well, it worked so far.
Well, I'm still alive, as you can hear.
Yes. Well, in the meantime, Syrian President Bashar Assad has promised that his remaining 1,000 troops will be out of Lebanon by next Tuesday. But this is down from a high of 14,000 troops in the country. Can you already feel that change? And how are Lebanese people responding to the troops leaving?
Well, Lebanese are very happy, actually. This has been something that was requested a long time ago. As for the Secret Services, they also left their offices, but there are lots of rumors in town that they could have moved into other offices, or they could have, because they're in civilians. And I think that even the United Nations and the international community are having lots of interest on that issue, which is very reassuring.
We understand that this is a time of great purging for the Lebanese people. I mean, the Syrians are there in the first place because of the civil war in Lebanon. That's when they went into the country. And we understand that this recently has been the first time many Lebanese have even really talked about that civil war. Can you tell me about that aspect of it?
Well, at the end of the civil war in 1989, after the signature of Taif Accords, there should have been a whole process of bridging gaps between the different groups in Lebanon. Unfortunately, this has not been done. There was no reconciliation during the 15 years of what we call here civil peace. And for a long time, power here in Lebanon has been working on polarizing the country and dividing the country. And I think that people are very aware that everybody has paid the price over the last decade. So Lebanese people that went down to the street came from different regions, different religions, different backgrounds. Almost a third of the population went down to the street to say that they wanted a free, sovereign Lebanon, and that war was behind us, and they wanted a united Lebanon, wanting to look for the future, building a modern country open to the rest of the world, in which there will be the possibility of respecting the specificities of each different group.
Those were the protests, but we understand also on April 13th there was a huge rally commemorating the Civil War. Unusual.
Yes, this was for the first time, actually. This is something that happened for the first time after 15 years of ending the civil war.
Mesbah Adab, a member of parliament in Lebanon. One last thought, Mesbah. The last Syrian troops expected to pull out April 26th, Tuesday. Is there going to be any commemoration by the Lebanese people? And do you think when you wake up Wednesday morning, you will feel as if you're in a different place?
Of course it will be a different place. It is already a different place because all of a sudden people can talk freely, people can move freely, and people are waking up little by little because there's still the effect of more than 10 or 15 years of this kind of protection, let's say. So let's hope for the best. And I think we definitely are living historical moments. Everybody's aware of it. And we will have a new parliament and the possibility of forming a new government and opening up to the future and to the rest of the world and also to the Arab world to which we belong.
Mesbah Adab is a member of parliament in Lebanon. He's speaking to us from Beirut. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robin. Bye-bye.
And when we return, Syrian troops may be leaving, but what does the future hold for Lebanon, and why does it matter? There's more coming up here and now. Continuing our look at Lebanon as Syria plans to withdraw its remaining troops, we turn now to Flint Leverett. He's a former senior director for Middle Eastern Affairs at the National Security Council, now at the Brookings Institution Savan Center for Middle East Policy, and author of the just-released Inheriting Syria, Bashar's Trial by Fire. And Flint, we just heard from a member of the Lebanese parliament. He says the troops are leaving, so are Syrian intelligence officers, people moving freely, speaking freely. Things are different. Your thoughts?
In some respects, it is, but I also would not understate the degree to which Syria is, in my view, going to continue to maintain a significant degree of influence. We shouldn't have any doubt that intelligence presence is also being reconfigured.
Well, it'll take us back a little and remind us, Syria's presence in Lebanon was really off the U.S. radar for a while.
When the 1990s, When the United States was trying to facilitate a peace treaty between Israel and Syria, the Syrian presence in Lebanon was basically put on a back burner. For the last 5 years, we haven't really had a Syria track. And I think in a post-September 11 environment in which this administration is trying to find ways to put pressure on state sponsors of terror like Syria, the Syrian presence in Lebanon became an inviting target.
A key ally of Syria's inside Lebanon is Hezbollah, considered a terrorist network.
Hezbollah and the importance that Hezbollah has in Lebanese politics is going to be one of the most important levers of influence inside Lebanon that Syria will continue to have. There are a lot of issues with Hezbollah. There is the problem that while Hezbollah is the largest single party in the Lebanese parliament and a very important force in Lebanese politics, it is also designated by the United States as a foreign terrorist organization. Before September 11, it had killed more Americans than any other terrorist organization in the world, and it still today maintains an international terrorist network that is more capable of hurting American interests around the world than Al-Qaeda is. There's also a problem for the Lebanese themselves. Now that we're actually entering a new era in Lebanese politics, I think this is an important card that Hezbollah could play to say, okay, you want to talk about democracy? Well, let's talk about democracy, and let's talk about something resembling one man, one vote for the first time in Lebanese history, which would really increase their power.
Yes, because they would get the votes. Well, tell us, what's going on behind the scenes? What is Syria doing?
I think there are probably a number of things going on. As I said, I think a lot of their links to Hezbollah, the way that Iranian supplies have come in to Damascus and then Syrian intelligence transshipped those supplies into southern Lebanon for Hezbollah, I think those kinds of networks are probably being put underground, under the table, more than they have been. And I think that Syria is working probably on a daily basis to work with its Lebanese political allies, Hezbollah and others, to monitor the daily jockeying, negotiating that's going on among various Lebanese political factions, and to help their allies, the people who have a pro-Syrian perspective, giving them guidance for how they should position themselves.
500,000 Syrians work in Lebanon, an important part of the workforce. Amnesty International is reporting that tens of Syrians have been killed or beaten in recent months by Lebanese angry about the assassination of Rafiq Hariri. Are those Syrian workers safe? Are they going to be pulled out? What happens there?
I expect that over time the situation is going to get regularized and that you will continue to have a significant number of Syrian expatriate workers in Lebanon, farmers, people who run construction businesses. These Syrian expatriate workers are a very needed, low-cost supply of labor.
There are a lot of economic ties that bind the two countries. Lebanon also has a lucrative heroin and hashish industry. Syria has been benefiting from that. Will that be cut off?
I doubt if it will be cut off or eliminated. I think those are ties which are likely to continue. I think even on more licit kinds of business, there are a lot of ties between the two countries that don't. And I think it's not accurate to say that they run entirely to the benefit of Syria. Syria is Lebanon's largest single export market. To the extent that Lebanon wants to be able to export to the wider Arab world, they basically need to be able to go overland through Syria.
We're talking to Flint Leverett. He's the author of a just-released book about Syrian President Bashar Assad. And just thinking about Lebanon, Syria's neighbor, we've spoken on this program to an architect who was building all sorts of nightclubs and fancy restaurants in Beirut, made to look like bombed-out buildings, sort of Civil War chic. A reminder that this is a country that had been so long at war. How would you characterize what's going on in Beirut?
Yeah, I suspect that there is very much a generational divide in how people are reacting, how people are responding. You talk about people who are building nightclubs today. Well, they are building nightclubs to appeal to a younger population that, for the most part, won't have that vivid a memory. I think there probably is a generalized sense on the part of Lebanese that they really don't want to go through this kind of experience again. But at the same time, there are some very, very important and fundamental political issues in Lebanon that have not been resolved. The civil war has been stopped, but many of the issues which generated the civil war have not been resolved. And I think one of the most important of these is going to be this distribution of political power, political assets, seats in the parliament.
Flint Leverett, senior fellow at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy, author of Inheriting Syria, Bashar's Trial by Fire. Flint, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And next week on Here and Now, weighing in on the new food pyramid. Will the colorful diagram lead to smaller waistlines or healthier bodies? Also, Billy Crystal's loving tribute to his uncle, record impresario Milt Gabler. That's Monday. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Religious leaders are lobbying a preemptive scolding at Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. This Sunday, Frist will deliver a much-anticipated taped speech about judges to Christian conservatives at an event called Justice Sunday. The theme, filibuster against people of faith. In a teleconference this morning, leaders urged Frist to back out of the event, and they slammed those who say that Democrats who oppose the president's judicial nominees are against people of faith. Reverend Clifton Kirkpatrick leads the Presbyterian Church in America, in which Frist is an active member.
We would like to urge Senator Frist to reconsider supporting such movements. We believe that this is a time when religious people need to come together and not to create a climate of divisiveness, and it's certainly not a time in which we turn political disagreements into religious conflicts.
Well, we have two political watchers with us on the line. Political science professor Jim Guth teaches at Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. He's the author of The Bully Pulpit. It's about evangelical and mainline Protestants. Welcome, professor.
Good morning.
And we're also joined again by Peter Kanellis. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Peter.
Thank you, Robin.
And, Professor, to you first, you listened in on this teleconference this morning. Senator Frist drew the ire of the evangelical Lutherans, African Methodists, Reformed Jews, others. Your thoughts?
Well, this is, of course, another example of the kind of division that we see within the American religious community. We have people who are divided on a whole series of issues. Some of these issues, of course, have been very prominent in the courts in recent years. And when conservative religious people mobilize to support their position, in this case on the nomination of President Bush's appointments to the appeals courts, people on the other side mobilize as well.
And Peter, as you know, this reporter of this event have compared themselves to civil rights activists. They say that people who use the filibuster against, you know, black African Americans and civil rights legislation decades ago, it's much the same as using the filibuster again today against their choices for nominees. Where does this stand? I mean, what are the polls showing? How are people responding to this debate?
I think that the Republicans are confident in a way that they probably weren't a month or two ago, that they can go ahead and eliminate the filibuster rule, and that the Democratic plan to use other rules to try to tie up the Senate will backfire on the Democrats.
Yeah, but as you know, the Democrats are saying the same thing's happening to Bill Frist. I mean, this really has tied two issues together, the judicial nominations and the filibuster, and he's the one who decides if he is going to use the so-called nuclear option and ban the filibuster.
Well, I don't think that when people originally were talking about eliminating the filibuster, I don't think they had anticipated the outcry that followed the Terry Schiavo case. And it was really after that case when there was real anger in religious communities toward federal judges who refused to reconsider that case, that the issue of getting President Bush's judicial appointees appointed, confirmed by the Senate, really became a religious cause.
Professor Guth, the Family Research Council, that's the conservative group organizing the Justice Sunday event, they say that event is not about questioning the faith of Democrats. Senator Frist says he's only giving a taped speech about the effort to give fair treatment to President Bush's judicial nominees, that it's about being fair.
Well, I think that I had a little difficulty recognizing the Family Research Council statement from what I heard from the mainline leaders in the press conference. I think that quite clearly when you have religious leaders advocating on any question, whether it's on the religious left or the religious right, groups both of which have been active in American politics, you have a tendency to imply, at least, that the position you take is a preferable one from a religious standpoint, and certainly the people at the National Council churches have been as guilty as that as the Christian conservatives have. But I think what has happened, of course, is that you've had a whole conjunction of events that have occurred here, the presidential election in which the president drew a lot of support from Christian conservatives, the Chavo case, and going back to the last Congress, the effort by Democrats to block several people, primarily on the abortion question. Many of the judges blocked were conservative Catholics, and that made it pretty easy to tie those things together.
Jim Guth, political science professor at Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina, the author of Bully Pulpit. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
And Peter, we want to continue with you, a Washington bureau chief of the Boston Globe. An internal Republican poll reportedly shows that 51% of Republicans surveyed are against Frist's plans to change the filibuster rules because of how they'd affect the judicial nominees. How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, they've certainly been working for the last few months to get veteran Republican senators who are very, very resistant to changing the rules to come around to the majority position. I think that Frist himself has decided that this is something he needs to pursue. And the only thing that will prevent him from doing it is if some of these senior Republicans, Arlen Specter, John Warner, John McCain, some others, sort of prevail on him by saying at the last minute that they won't go along with it.
Well, and the fact that the head of his own church, the leader of the Presbyterian Church, has sort of rebuked him. Is that going to matter to Bill Frist? Or?
Well, Bill Frist is running for president, almost certainly. He's already said that he's going to be leaving the Senate in 2006 and has not in any way denied the idea that he's doing that to prepare a presidential campaign. And, the religious right is a very crucial voting bloc in Republican primaries. And Senator Frist is a medical doctor. He's a man of the Congress. He isn't a perfect fit with the religious right. So I think he has actually a lot to gain from doing something that is going to ingratiate himself with the religious right.
Well, we want to ask you about another hot-button political issue, just because we've got you. Nomination of John Bolton as U.N. ambassador. The White House is standing by Bolton, but we now know that former Secretary of State Colin Powell spoke with some of the Republicans who are increasingly reluctant to vote to confirm Bolton. How do you think that's going to play out?
It's very unclear. They're not going to meet until after May 9th. So what happens in the next couple of weeks will be very, very important. And I suspect that there'll be more attention given to some of the charges against Bolton, generally dealing with his temperament and his retaliating against subordinates who disagreed with him. If more and more of those cases come out, there will be sort of an accumulation of negative energy around Bolton. And I think the White House would consider withdrawing the nomination.
Even though right-wing talk show hosts are incensed about this and urging their listeners to flood the senator's phone lines, you don't think there'd be from the ground up pressure as well?
You mean pressure to keep Bolton?
Yeah.
To stay with Bolton? I think there is some pressure to stay with Bolton. I think that also you can look at this combined with the filibuster issue and a few other things, the ethics charges against Tom DeLay. I think there's a sense that in the next few weeks we're going to see just how strong the Republican Party is and how able they are to keep people in line. And so there are larger benefits to the White House to win on Bolton, to get the filibusters overruled, and to have the ethics charges removed against Tom DeLay. And, their ability to keep their own coalition together will be crucial in all three cases.
Peter Canellos, Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe. Pete, thank you.
Thank you.
And still to come, Utah Valley State College was a quiet school in the heart of Mormon country until filmmaker Michael Moore came to town. We'll explain. You're listening to Here and Now. The NFL will hold its 2005 college draft this weekend at New York City's Javits Center. This annual event has attracted more and more attention in recent years, to the point where some fans anticipate the draft more eagerly than they do the games. Paul Attner covers the NFL for the Sporting News. He's a veteran draft day reporter. He spoke with Only a Game's Bill Littlefield, who asked him what one word would he use to sum up the NFL draft experience.
Loony.
That's very good. The one I had in mind.
A couple of years ago, Bill, I went to the draft with the intention not to cover the draft itself, but to cover the circus around it. And I was even shocked and delighted, by the way, by who goes there and how they behave and in the various degrees of people that are attracted by this event. It's really a kind of a cross section of American culture, I think.
Well, how is it that this annual event has grown from one that nobody cared much about, it wasn't televised, to one that features seven rounds of TV coverage over the course of 2 days and generates weeks of pre-draft speculation?
It's the closest the fan can come to being a general manager, because he can actually have these mock drafts and say, okay, if I was in that seat, this is who I would draft. I mean, a lot of the times it's hard to call plays and all this other stuff, but the draft, you can study it, you get all this material, you got everything on the internet, you get Mel Kiper holding your hand, and so you can get this knowledge, and then you can be the general manager for a day. And that has a lure over people that just, it really is fascinating to see how it works.
The draft is held in New York each year, which I assume is because the powers that be have decided that Jets and Giants fans must have the opportunity to paint their faces green and blue, respectively, and loudly boo every
exactly.
pick that the Jets and Giants make. Has this become just a tradition that will last forever?
The NFL had talked, at least a few years ago, we're talking about taking it on the road. I think that probably appropriate, the circus on the road.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I have not heard any more talk of that. I mean, they've moved it this year, as you said, from the Garden to the Javits Center. But I think they should take it on the road, quite frankly. And I tell you something, Bill, as sad as this might sound, I think that they could bring it to places and really draw huge crowds into arenas in various cities, because it's taken on this subculture of its own where people almost feel like it's an event to be there so they can brag to their grandchildren that they're in an NFL draft.
It's like I went to the Super Bowl. Yeah, when I went to the draft.
And then you can join. I mean, like one of my great thrills of this draft I went to is that among the attendants was Miss Liberty Bell, this scantily clad woman that I guess was a draft fanatic. I haven't figured out the connection yet, but it was interesting.
Each year, there are more draft reports that refer to players, quote, tight skin, quote, hip swivel, quote, tight bubble, and, quote, V-shaped torsos. Are we sure this is about the draft? What's going on here?
It's the Chippendales have invaded the NFL. It's, new jargon to me, too. I've been fortunate enough to be around a lot of general managers and drafts in the NFL and never heard of any of that stuff. It's all new language invented by people trying to impress each other about their intimate knowledge of stuff that doesn't matter one bit to who you draft and who you don't.
Here's an opportunity to take a jab at one of your employer's competitors. What does ESPN stand to gain by broadcasting all seven rounds of the NFL draft?
I think they appeal, Bill, to the hardcore fan. It's become this event within an event, and I think that the hardcore fan appreciates that ESPN puts this on. Or that, or they're fascinated by Mel Kiper's hair. I'm not sure which one, but it has this loyal audience. And again, part of the story I did was talk to ESPN, and they have every year their ratings go up. Now they're not huge ratings, but they have significant ratings to justify this program, and it keeps getting stronger every year. I won't say it's made for television because it isn't that exciting, but obviously it has a place within television because of the hours and the information that they can give you during that time span.
Everybody waits to see who the number one pick will be, but then everybody also wants to know who the number 255 pick will be. He, of course, is the last guy picked in the draft. He's known as Mr. Irrelevant. You want to tell me who you think number one will be and who you think Mr. Irrelevant will be this year?
Who's number one? At this point, I would think it's going to be a quarterback, a Smith or from Utah, Rodgers from California. But there could be some trades that will alter that. I have no clue who the last guy is going to be. Whoever it is, the people who stay and watch that until that's done, they ought to deserve an award at the same time he gets an award.
Paul Attner covers the NFL for the Sporting News. He spoke with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. A new documentary gives us a behind-the-scenes look at a battle that pitted neighbor against neighbor at a quiet college campus just 40 miles south of Salt Lake City, Utah. It was at the height of last year's presidential election when the Utah Valley State College student government invited Fahrenheit 9/11 filmmaker Michael Moore to speak at the school. That invitation sparked a bitter debate in the conservative town among students, community members, and professors.
This is what our democracy is about.
If he wants to come here for free, stand on public property and speak all day long, that's fine. I'm not paying for it. That's what I'm saying.
It's a man who sold his movie to the government of Cuba, France, Russia, and Germany.
You walk through the streets, and you feel like if you like Michael Moore, you're going to hell because everybody thinks that you're a bad Mormon, and that's not it at all.
And you're afraid of what he said.
No, I'm not.
You're afraid
of police want to shut us down.
And that's just part of the opening scene of a new documentary by student filmmaker Stephen Greenstreet. It's called This Divided State, and it tells of that time in his home state. And he joins us in the studio now to tell us more. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
Let's explain how you made this film. You were actually a student at Brigham Young University.
That's correct.
And you dropped out of school, maxed out your credit cards to make this film. Why?
I heard the news that Utah Valley State College had invited Michael Moore, and being familiar with the ultra-conservative communities in Utah, I knew that Michael Moore was going to cause a lot of uproar and protest. And so I just knew I'd get great footage. I just grabbed my camera and ran to the school and basically spent the next 4 or 5 months there.
As it got kind of crowded at that college because in addition to inviting Michael Moore, the school then invited conservative speaker Sean Hannity for balance.
Yeah, there was this outpouring from the community saying, well, how dare you invite a liberal without inviting a conservative?
Among the many debates that these two invitations launched was one about how much the two speakers were paid.
Well, the initial protest from the community was, you know, you're spending, you know, $40,000 of your speaking fee on Michael Moore. And, you know, they protested that that was a misuse of funds because Michael Moore misrepresented the community. And so they brought out Sean Hannity, who quote unquote came for free, but also charged the school for his private jet, including fuel and crew. And that was about $50,000.
So this caused angst. But first of all, you have such a terrific vantage point as a filmmaker at this point because you're also a Mormon.
That's right.
So tell us about this town, Orem, Utah, and Utah Valley State College.
Well, when you drive into Orem City, you're presented with a huge stone sign that says, Welcome to Family City, USA. And you've got a large Republican stronghold. And obviously, you have a large Mormon culture. You have these deep-rooted value systems that people feel an extra need to defend.
And one of those defenders was Kay Anderson, a community member. Now, the college held a public forum where he spoke out against the ticketed Michael Moore event. He made a unique offer to student Joe Vogel, who was organizing the event. Let's listen.
And I would just like to say that if Joe Vogel decides to change his mind, I will buy back every ticket you've sold. And I have a $25,000 cashier's check made out to UVSC right here to start it.
Who was Kay Anderson? Does he have that kind of money? And why was he so motivated?
Well, Kay Anderson is a neighbor of UVSC, not a student, and he has a daughter who goes to UVSC. He's a multimillionaire, I guess, from what I understand, in real estate. And yeah, just went in there with a check of $25,000 of his own money, basically saying, I will give this to you, that way we won't have to bring in Michael Moore. And as you heard, the crowd was just absolutely flabbergasted at the extent that this guy was going to prevent Michael Moore from speaking.
To stop a speech. And did he say why?
He felt that this debate, this argument was splitting the community up, but was driving a wedge into the community. And he felt that offering this money could maybe end that.
And I want to ask about that because we've been speaking of a Mormon community as if it's assumed that it's conservative. It sounds to me like what you discovered is that it doesn't all speak in one voice.
That was one of the most amazing discoveries of the film, is that there were many voices that came out in this film. I mean, conservatives who thought Michael Moore, agreed with Michael Moore and said that he should come. And for a college campus, it was wonderful to see all these once thought apathetic students in the hallways, you know, debating the issues.
Well, yeah, I'm wondering if it was always wonderful because you're a Mormon as well. were people being asked, you know, where do you stand on this issue?
Yeah, and I am I'm a liberal registered Democrat, and that conflicts a lot in the Mormon community. And one of the big debates that came out of this film was, is it okay to be a Mormon and a liberal at the same time? And a lot of labeling went on that saying that people who were siding with Michael Moore had betrayed their Mormon religion and that they had betrayed their family name. And there was really some ugly accusations going on, you know, from a religious standpoint.
Well, before we move on, I'm just curious that we know there were death threats against the two students who wanted to bring Michael Moore to the school. What about you? Did people attack you?
I wasn't attacked. And so, I mean, I did get, you know, hate mail and hate email, and I got a couple phone calls before I had to change my number after the film was made. At my school, actually, at Brigham Young University, it was hard to find any support. You know, all I did was mention Michael Moore, and immediately people did not want to support me.
Yeah. Well, as we said, both speeches went forward. Sean Hannity spoke at the college before Moore appeared. Here's a clip of his speech.
Just as a little test here, because there's always some in every crowd. I know you're here. I just want you to identify yourselves. Here, little liberal, liberal, liberals. Here, little liberals. All right, all the liberals stand up. All the liberals.
Well, I'm curious, filmmaker Stephen Greenstreet, how many people did stand up?
I would probably say about 10 out of a crowd of 8,000.
Mm-hmm.
And they were immediately booed and laughed at and pointed at. And I can't deny the fact that Hannity's speech was nothing but a bully rally. It was really a discomforting thing to sit through.
Let's listen to a little of Michael Moore's speech.
Here. Who would like to believe that Utah is not part of the United States. You see, we're so special, we don't have to believe in the Bill of Rights in Utah.
It sounds like those 15 liberals who showed up at Sean Hannity's speech found some friends to go see Michael Moore. Was there a big turnout for him?
Equally as much as Sean Hannity's speech.
But again, what's the outcome of all of this?
Civil discourse failed miserably on both sides. People did not get along. People didn't even understand or talk to each other. There was just a lot of name-calling and threats and just kind of blatant immaturity about really getting along with each other. No one really took the time to sit down and really understand what the real issues were. And I feel that was a problem. I think it's a microcosm for really what's going on in the nation right now, the kind of division between the red and the blue states that we hear so much about on the news. And I really think that the myth of this red and blue nation, it really needs to be deconstructed. A hero of mine, Barack Obama, said that we are a purple nation, that we are actually a mixture of many voices. And I think that this film shows that there are many voices that aren't necessarily being heard in America right now.
What's been the aftermath for the students?
Afterwards, Joe Vogel, the vice president, was forced to resign under pressures of a lawsuit by Mr. K. Anderson suing the student body for misuse of funds. And so he lost his scholarship and his position, and he and Jim, who were best friends...
Jim was the president of the student council.
That's right, aren't speaking to each other. And so there was a lot of ugly fallout.
That's filmmaker Stephen Greenstreet. He dropped out of Brigham Young University to cover the story at neighboring Utah Valley State College, a controversy over Michael Moore's speaking at the school. The result is a film called This Divided State. And Stephen, quick question. Are you going back to school?
I was going to film school, and I've learned about 16 years worth of film school in about 5 months, so I'm off and running at this point.
Well, thanks for running by here.
Yeah, thank you.
For more information on the film, This Divided State, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.